Klein Trump.
Any close examination of Bob's life might yield unpleasantries, though he'd recognize the onset of punctuated equilibrium and the confluence of Spurley's efforts, he'd taken stock and would not surrender his anonymity at large. To do such a deal at this crossroads would be to trade catharsis for coffin, a fight or flight. With this gauntlet thrown down, it increasingly seemed that conventional social connectivity was a much more pragmatic remedy than to allow oneself to be exposed to the masses on a lark. His success was to have remained principally unknown to all he'd encountered throughout his life. His failure, the same. And now the jig was up. It was no longer enough to just do stuff. This realization created enormous challenges. In Yale psychology professor Julian Jayne's 1976 publication, The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, Jayne suggests that primitive man was not a creature of consciousness, but rather acted in direct accordance to the voice of God, heard God speak. As consciousness evolved through the ages, so did conflict. There are some historical examples of those theories, artifactually. Joan of Arc would be one. Religious extremism, another. Even those behaviors on the spectrum today associated with schizophrenia can be tied to shamanesque figures of another epoch. Bob was no shaman, never heard the voice of God. But man, that Annie could get into his head something good.
Are you in a crisis, Bob Beam?
Isn't the whole world, Annie?
Bob sat himself center couch, flicked on the TV. Another debate over guns. Bob sometimes didn't know what the fuss was all about. It seemed to him that words were as lethal as any weapon. And words, unburdened by background checks, were available at all times to all people. Still, Bob understood that murder by word was most typically employed as a weapon of domestic dispute and dog whistles. Such make it a bit of media play, but none the happiness of a warm gun. If society and media choose to posture themselves as culturally anti-killing, some common sense control over guns may suffice. Still, he wasn't sure this yearning for reform or good news stories was genuine. It could be said that the public yearning, once bent on belief reinforcement, had now become a hunger for insecurity empowered. In fact, there was an argument to be made that what America was yearning for was a hybrid between a race war and a civil war, a massive movement by gangs and militias to upset a fraudulent order, posed and imposed by a wealthy few and their conveniently unwitting puppets for profit, those right-brain Hollywood narcissists in their self-righteous hypocrisy as they do the bad guy's bidding, bad crumbs and corresponding front-person crusts bound together by dough. This, it seemed to him, was the only reasonable explanation for the bloated blonde high priest of branding and masturbatory populist who'd become a media sensation and then some during his candidacy for president, and bringing the Republican Party, so inviting of the stupid, to stupider. Bob liked Jupiter. It had been a cosmos full of communist cosmonauts over Indochina that had once frightened boy Bob in a dream. Ever since, he'd looked to Jupiter for high ground. But back on Earth, Bob liked Woodview, California. He liked California enough that when right-wing media maligned it, he'd make mental arguments with their methodology. In a red culture that so self-celebrated its origin of farming and other symbols of Americana, were they naive to the fact that California not only supplied 60% of all agriculture domestically, but also was the state that produced both McDonald's and the Hell's Angels? If there were a claim for rural heroism, outlaw ideology, or down-home hard-working men and women in all the United States, it was certainly California. How dare any marginalize the long golden state? Damn them to the devil, Bob thought.
Do you think it's possible to sell your soul to Satan, to a darkness, Bob Beam?
A darkness?
Yeah, like Led Zeppelin. Didn't they, my gruff goat?
Bob flicked the channel. A young pop star sold acne medication.
It's manufacturing, Annie. Dark things are manufactured. They're not endemic. We don't give ourselves to dark things. We create them.
Are you creating dark things, Gruff Bob Beam?
Bob's head began to throb. If only he were 9, picking into a rock wall, chipping out artifacts of 10,000-year-old sea life. Turritella shell structures, mussels, and exene grayfish. Or maybe riding his red Schwinn raining fire on rivers. He could have been an astronaut, he thought.
What about space, the cosmos, Bob Beam?
I want to go to Jupiter, Annie.
Jupiter, Gruff.
Stupider. I'm just so goddamn...
It's not stupid, Bob. You're not stupid. But you don't have to go 588 million kilometers from Earth. Think practically, just for a second.
Annie did have a way with Bob's brain. Instead of dreaming to go to Jupiter, where there was little if any chance of social connectivity, he set his mind on hosting an afternoon social for the residents of Sweet Dog Lane. He'd call a rental company, get tables, picnic chairs, and sun umbrellas, and set the stage on his front lawn. He'd sit up evenings individualizing invitations in the form of cute collages. With his X-Acto knife and cuticle scissors, he'd cut into photo and art books, tailoring each collage to his best estimate of the personalities on his block by the face of their homes. Then he'd pick the right afternoon, put the data of the social on the collage invitations, walk mailbox to mailbox, inserting accordingly. It was Saturday and sunny. Bob set up the briquette grill for burgers and dogs, made 100 deviled eggs, and had soda and beers in coolers. With the first round of meat on the grill, he sat at the center picnic chair on the lawn awaiting the arrival of his neighbors. He'd set 1 p.m. as his start time. At 1:30, he heard the distant approach of circus music when then, the first of 40 black limousines cruised past his house. Windows rolled down, his neighbors cast contemptuous glances upon Bob as they glided by. As he watched them pass, his eyes drifted to a bevy of floral garlands piled 4 feet high on the burned-out skeleton of Helen Mayo's house. He'd inadvertently invited a neighborhood of strangers pre-committed to the funeral of Helen Mayo. Only Bob had not been invited. From the back of the line of limos, his ex-wife in her ice cream truck, randomly reconfirming her self-righteous rebellion. No sooner than they all appeared did they vanish into the hills, the ice cream music trailing distantly with them. Bob ate a deviled egg and sat till sunset.
It's a start, Bob Beam. You gave it a go.
I gave it a go.
With night's descent, a galaxy of stars were stripped of their cover, and to the resident of 1528 Sweet Dog Lane returned a nocturnal native knowledge. In the night's finale, as with life's curtain call, there is just no such a thing as posthumous penance. He stood from his picnic chair and lumbered over to the Pontiac, opened the door, sat in the driver's seat, turned on the car, and pressed play on the CD player. Phil Oakes's voice.
There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone, and I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone.
Station 9. Bloated Black Bodies.
In Bob's saute did his memory connect moments of longing and dreams. Sharpness of image and sound. If he was to hunt social connectivity, he would have to begin by retracing the wires of his brain and reawakening his lucidity of perception. In 2005, after executing a contract in the Ascension Parish of Louisiana, Hurricane Katrina blasted the brackish inlets, infrastructure, and population alike. With the airport closed due to weather, and later to erroneous reports of civilian sniping, Bob took up in a local YMCA that the American Red Cross hosted for shelter. Of the 150 cots set up in the indoor basketball court, Bob was assigned cot 21 left. The hurricane's winds had felled cell towers, but Bob had thought ahead and brought a sat phone. As he lay his head down, listening to the whirling winds outside, he tried to place a call to HQ. But even the sat phone didn't want to break through the storm.
ABC, CBA, ABC, CBA.
And off to sleep he went. By daybreak, word of the massive flooding and frenzy was building, but the skies had calmed and Bob was able to get through to HQ. Down in New Orleans, among the carnage, cutoff, and curfews, there was a large nursing home smack dab in the middle of the flood zone. Bob sensed an emerging opportunity. Given the force of the storm and the amount of organic projectiles, there would be ample cover for concussive injury. Bob was deployed. He joined a group of humanitarian volunteers putting in their boat from a de facto Garden District launch. The day, warm and calm. The water, warm and black. Everything quite still. The only air moving above the city were the pockets rotor-washed by Coast Guard rescue helicopters. Bob, his mallet holstered, informed the volunteers that there may be a number of elderly holed up in a nursing home in the flooded CBD. The sailors set sail past bloated floaters, the dead bodies who'd seen too much sun, all face down and spread eagle in the calm water. Upon making entrance into the semi-submerged nursing home, Bob and a few of the volunteers found themselves in utter darkness and knee-deep in black water. The windows of the several-storied building had been boarded up in preparation for Katrina's fury. With the volunteers dispatching to the highest floors, intending to work their way down, Bob remained one up from the entry floor and found himself with the requisite privacy. One hand on a moonbeam, the other on his surreptitiously holstered mallet, Bob kicked in the doors of several residential cubicles on floor two. But with no oldies in sight, he sensed it was a losing game. Usually, when a location has been cleared or evacuated from a hurricane flood zone, the first rescue team on site would indicate it with a spray-painted X on the building's white side.
White side. Identification of assault side. Specifically in the targeting or navigation of buildings for clarity of comms.
Not so the nursing home. Nonetheless, a bust. He would dread the inevitable after-action report. Surrendering, Bob went back to the boat, sensing that the volunteers had at least two additional floors to search. He could be long gone before they noticed. With no obligation to valor, he yanked the rope pull of the outboard, abandoning his fellow searchers, taking a slow cruise back toward the Garden District on a newfound calm black sea now flooding the streets of New Orleans. In the distance, some blocks away, he saw a random house fire. Here, the image of its burn surrounded by water conjured in Bob a reminiscence of his Molotov cocktails inflaming the river of his youth. It gave an almost surreal quality to his journey, or a flashback to Disneyland's Pirates of the Caribbean ride. A water moccasined serpent slithered by on the surface beside the boat, more bodies bloated by the gases of a bacterial rave, and something in all this alchemy brought Bob a cathartic sense of momentarily connected bliss, the kind he might, in a pinch, one day pick from his back pocket were he ever in the greater Gulf Coast area again, and requiring of sensory soothing. This brief flirtation with a lightness of being brought Annie's voice again to his ear.
Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Can you hear me softly singing, Bob Beam? Considering killing the elderly in a disaster zone. Don't you fear the devil? Beautiful Bob Beam.
And with that, Bob saw himself among those full of rage against their own insignificance. Registered voters, they might be called. Some with access to polling places and some without, but all subject to the vainglorious gestalt. The subsiding floodwaters were beginning to expose cells of celebrity and their cancerous, divisive detriment deluged by adenosine triphosphate, delivering fame's de-evolution. It should be noted that New Orleans' famous goat of Algiers did survive the flood.
Goat of Algiers. This goat was a staple at many New Orleans music festivals.
Indeed. Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. Oh boy, Bob.
Woodview County, July 17th, 2016.
911, what's your emergency?
I got my 2020s on them right now as we speak.
May I have your name, ma'am?
Oh, for goodness sake, I'm so very sorry. I'm the daughter of Mrs. Helen Mayo. You know, the lady who just passed. I'm standing on a scissor lift here at the demo site of my dear mother's home. I've got this scissor lift at full vertical extension, and I can see right down into that terrible man's backyard.
Your name, ma'am?
Oh, forgive me. I'm Helen Mayo Jr.
Helen Mayo Jr., ma'am.
Yes, that's correct. Now, listen to what I have to tell you.
You did say Helen Mayo Jr., yes?
Yes, I told you that. That's correct. I'm Helen Mayo Jr. But listen, please. The lift is a little wobbly. He's out there in that yard of his, pruning a melaleuca tree in all this wind with his belly out and sweating in his skivvies. I know he's a white man, but sometimes he just looks very Chinese to me. Those awful eyes of his swell with bad deeds. And I don't believe this chink is just bonsai gardening, if you know what I mean.
Ma'am, bonsai gardeners are Japanese, not Chinese. Now, I want to suggest to you that you come down off that scissor lift. I would hate to hear that you'd been cited as a peeping Tom, and it's a bit gusty out there today.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness!
Ma'am? Ma'am? Ma'am?
Complainant's phone connection went dead.
Station 10. Miami, Miami.
Miami had long been considered a zone too conspicuous for activities of intervention by Scottsdale program operatives. But with the Western Desert Community Contracts having long since transferred command and control away from Ludestar and his New Guinean team, Ludestar had seemingly gone rogue and set up independent operations. Financing unknown. Through a network of operators had Ludestar's rumored activities come to Bob's attention. FLIR drones.
FLIR, forward-looking infrared aeronautic systems.
It had been observed that maybe mapping the movements of retirees in the greater South Beach area. While there were plenty of international contracts available, Ludestar had always had great appreciation for the social life that came with American operators, with the exception of Bob, who kept himself apart. It was likely cost prohibitive for the cannibal to be constantly flying operators abroad, so Ludestar might have chosen Miami as an area of operations where he could recruit Inconus.
Inconus, inside the continental United States.
Best practices would dictate approvals and appropriations from USG when operating Inconus. But it wouldn't be good politics simply to deport men because they wore grass skirts, and Ludestar could take great advantage of this hall pass of politically correct cowardice. A suspicious uptick in the premature passing of senior snowbirds in Florida had caught the attention of the local press, most impetuously the Miami Herald. Bob had many close calls with that paper. His work in the Caribbean in early 2010 familiarized him with that paper's political proselytizing to the abundant Haitian diaspora of its distribution. This vested interest was reflected by some formidable Miami Herald muckraking. Ludestar's alleged activities concerned Bob. The flamboyant cannibal, fascinated by narcotics, had proven himself loose to the tongue on several prior occasions. It was, in fact, this unsavory characteristic that had lost Ludestar command and control of the Scottsdale program several years earlier. Was it possible that Spurley Coltier's sudden interest in Bob had some connection to the columns of insinuation on the pages of the Herald? It had never occurred to Bob to specifically ask Spurley what publication he worked for. It rarely occurred to Bob to ask anyone other than himself anything. But now he found himself asking of his own thoughts. Perhaps he should pay Ludestar a visit. He entered his bathroom and sat before the marble in consultation. He needed a directive. While finding the odd face of wisdom or fury before him, the mining of marble's dynamic disclosures mandate meditative capitulation of consciousness. On this day was that capitulation a reach for Bob. Beset by thoughts of Annie, he was monkey-minded. In addition, he registered this day's lighting, lackluster to stonal symphonies of structure. He wandered back to the bedroom, sat on the edge of his bed, and clicked on the television where the blonde buffoon, aligned with law and order, like a cartoon. It got Bob thinking. Could this high priest of branding himself be conspiring on behalf of the unbranded? Could this translate to the preservation of that one-armed banditry that served the candidate's casino's branded benefit?
One-armed banditry, referring to the elderly in their playing of slot machines.
Had Spurley been a proxy of reconnaissance? It was all beginning to make sense. The candidate's own Knight of the Long Knives may be on a pooch, or rather approach, as he himself famously had residences and golf courses in the greater Miami area. All roads lead to Lewdstar.
The Knight of the Long Knives, a series of executions ordered by Hitler in 1934 to consolidate his absolute hold on power in Nazi Germany.
Bob weighed his options. He could drive the Pontiac from Woodview to South Beach in 4 days, five if he stopped in New Orleans. Or he could jump a plane and be there in a matter of hours. His resistance to flight and avoidance of any sense memory that Annie's last departure may conjure. He decided to put Pontiac to pavement and pick his back pocket courage connection from that prior Big Easy Bliss. The America Bob drove from Woodview to New Orleans was not that one of lore, not the one he'd known in his earliest cross-continental automotive excursions, not the one of pay-later gas stations, vintage diners, and two-lane roads. Only the trains remained a spirit refuge to modernity's craven trumpery. There were few remaining romantic vistas experienced in solitude, but rather interstates, strip malls, retail emporiums, traffic, roadwork, and bottlenecks. America, it seemed to Bob, was no longer that beautiful girl who'd birthed him, but instead the ghost of a girl he'd never known. Driving at night through the intermittent expanses, could Bob sometimes see the distant amber lights of isolated compounds, perhaps prisons, perhaps casinos. In either case, somebody was in there losing. It seemed many of the towns were built either on the back of Votex or on the job security offered by various states' corrections departments. At one diner stop in San Antonio, Bob sat at a counter where he was drawn into conversation by a grinning septuagenarian traveler from Appalachia. Bob impulsively asked,
"What's with all the incest in your area?"
He watched the old man's grin go grim. Then the old man looked to Bob with defiance. He stepped up and answered Bob's question quietly. "Just folks getting by." And so it was. Bob finished a grilled cheese sandwich, last French fry, and final gulp of Pepsi with the bulk of its remaining crushed ice. He paid out for himself and the 70-something sister sodomizer, then pointed the Pontiac to the Parrish State and Pontchartrain. New Orleans would be his one sleepover stop en route Miami and Mission. He found a flop house on Lafayette Street. After taking his turn in the hall-end common shower where he washed road from body, then went walking. Following the sound of the French Quarter, he drifted into a bar-resto for calamari and an adult beverage. On the TV above the bar was a live broadcast of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Bob was interested in hearing what the delegate from Guam might have to say. But between the over-commentary of a former New York mayor boasting anti-crime bluster and the chatter amongst the bar barons, Guam was not to be heard. Nonetheless, the visual of their floral shirts and leis offered something less conventional for the convention. That's when the millennials put Bob in their sights. 3 blocks from where Bob sat with his plate of fried calamari was a youth-oriented club called Checkpoint Charlie's, the hub for acid-dropping youth. 2 of its young trippers had gone walking and perceived Bob through the glass as a sideways-sitting sphinx with a candelabra in his mouth. Within minutes had Bob been dosed with 7 hits of liquid acid. Within an hour, images once reserved for marble manifested ubiquitously. Bob's world altered aggressively. As the blood flow to the control centers of his brain reduced, connectivity was enhanced by lysergic hallucinations. Conversations between 2 cultures, between 2 languages that rarely exist, and were now lucid and active. Parts of the brain that hadn't known each other before were put in the same room. The visual cortex played mediator, while neuronal networks parted ways and slept in default. In this vortex, both atomic and molecular mitosis, Bob had found a connectedness in New Orleans, just not the one he planned for, that one he'd hoped to pull as a bliss from his back pocket. Nonetheless, Bob would adapt as he always did. After 35 hours dancing between expanding flowers, grab-ass gypsies, and bingo parlor bivouacs, Bob woke from final slumber to find himself a day and a half behind schedule. Pontiac to pavement, he set his sights on Miami. As the Pontiac's radio reported two-day-old news from Cleveland, the candidate's mail-order bride plagiarized speech. Black militias opened carried AK-47s, and the blonde one thought it neato to leave NATO in the lurch. Bob mused the likelihood that a new norm may visit America. Random car bombings, claimed, erroneously or not, with the conceit, provocations, or patronage to Middle Eastern manifestos manufactured in Saudi madrasas. You can't depress the depressed, and fear is the folly of static scoundrelism. Bob was immune. Arrived in Miami late the following afternoon. He went big and checked into the Fountain Blue Hotel, 13 floors up in room 1406. Bob dropped his bag on the bed, flipped on the television. 'Twas the final night of the convention, and the Mussolini of Mayberry was fomenting his flock. It seemed to Bob the hypothesis was clear. Between the id and the superego had the sheep traded a love of their own children to cry, "Look at me, I'm a pisser on a tree." Ouch goes the human heart. Out comes the orator's brain fart, reminiscent of the day he suggested that were he not his daughter's father, may she be his fuck. She no less alluring that her jaw remains static in speech. Her brothers, the new generation Uday and Kuse, poach precious protected panthers for party pictures and purient posts. Now hear their father, the Jesus of Jonestown, this blind man to Newtown, spits bile aplenty to bitch us all down. And with the lonesome roads above the crowd, Bob switched the TV off, moved to the window and opened the blinds to the bikini clatters, the beach, and the big blue. From his back pocket, his phone called out to him. It was a photo of a woman's forearm with a deep horizontal gash, bleeding profusely. No message attached except its sender's code name, Anna Surma.
Anna Surma, ancient Greek goddess of exhibitionism.
Who, with some follow-up, Bob saw had also posted the photograph on social media. Bob knew that arm anywhere. It was Annie's. The slash, he thought, showed all the hallmarks of Guinean fanfare. Was it possible that Annie had been nabbed by Lewdstar operatives? Was this a warning, a war declaration, or a soap chip?
Soap chip. A psychological operations tactic where fake communiques are intended to demoralize combatants.
Had Bob been surveilled? If so, by whom? And if Lewdstar had Annie, for what? While Bob was no creature of panic, the measure of the uncertainties and the palpable paranoia concerning Annie's well-being led to noticeable perspiration. Showers had always helped Bob clear his mind and prepare himself for remedies requiring rigorous focus. Bob showered. From his go-bag, he pulled a black linen suit, businessman shoes, and a pressed white shirt. He dressed and exited the hotel onto Ocean Drive. Crowded with tourists, beachcomers and goers, shoppers, bicyclists, and big, ostentatious cars, there it happened. From a perpendicular street, the marchers of many appeared with their Yellow Lives Matter banners, and all with yellow blonde hair and eyes of Nazi blue. They chanted, "Make America more yellow." Bob was reminded of Zimmerman's Nobel Prize-winning words. "The sun isn't yellow. It's chicken." Then, kaboom, flicker flash, smoky-dokey and fire. A concussive Semtex car bomb blasted, sending shockwaves, blast wind, and fragmentations through a 500-square-meter radius. Bob was thrown backwards but uninjured, shy a brief bout of auditory exclusion. After standing back up, dusting himself off, and evening his breathing, he surveyed the street before him and identified the unmistakable odor of plastic explosives. This one was particular, and Bob guessed, from a stock that had recently come available through demilitarized former Czech army caches. Semtex it was. He then saw through the mass yellow-blonde bloody body parts, the material destruction, and fallback ejecta's rain, redevoured by the crater. Through the smoke and the fire flashed the face of an exotic dark-haired woman exiting a damaged building from across the street. Their eyes briefly locked. A until black smoke and red flames obliterated the view. Sirens started to fill the air, and their hearkening of that ice cream music, most wretched, suggested his retreat. Bob made his way back into the hotel and drifted to the lobby bar. While chaos dominated the atmosphere of guests, employees, and scrambling police officers seeking to secure the greater crime scene, Bob approached one who appeared least discombobulated. This was bartender El Greco Hernandez. With the televised convention above the bar, Bob asked El Greco simply, "Are you serving?" To which El Greco responded,
"I'm always serving."
It occurred to Bob El Greco might be a bit of a football bat.
Football bat. An individual or way of doing things that is particularly odd.
Bob sat at the bar, finding it the only reasonably quiet refuge available. He slowly sipped some Russian spirits, staring quizzically at himself in the mirror behind the bar. He contemplated his vision, mission, objective, strategies, and action plan, beginning with his immediate situational awareness. First, he had a bomb scene outside the hotel that had clearly created some disruption for many. Secondly, he had El Greco here, more interested in television than invested in any situational awareness of his own. Thirdly, there was the original problem, that Ludestar may be active and surveilled in a way that could compromise Bob's cover and may need neutralizing. And now there was this added dilemma that Annie may be involved, caught in a crossfire, or in either case, bleeding. El Greco switched the bar television channels back and forth between coverage of the afterblast in front of the hotel and the convention in Cleveland. Bob racked his brain and sought his dog's nose for a starting point. It was then that a woman's voice came by surprise from the stool beside him.
"You're Bob?"
Bob nods.
"I am Anna Surma."
Bob turned. It was the woman he'd seen after the blast. On first impression, hers was a mischievous, if not mystical, beauty. She looked roughly Annie's age and the kind another man may take for a lesbo-leaning lunatic.
"Don't look at me,"
Anna Surma instructed, then whispered.
"We can't be observed talking to each other."
Bob dutifully turned away, but only to adjust his observation of her to the mirror's reflection. Anna Surma did the same, saying,
"That's better. You know, this is all unsustainable. We are near the end of days, Bob."
Bob nodded, as if to a nuisance claim.
"Do you know who I am?"
"I think you sent me a picture,"
Bob said.
"Are you responsible for that car bomb?"
She responded bluntly.
"Don't ask me personal questions."
Bob shifted in his seat. She continued.
"You know the Marble Palace Hotel? The one with the terrible gold gilding? Everything you're looking for is there."
"Are you from Scottsdale?" Bob asked.
Anna Surma began to giggle. The giggle became a laugh. Soon she guffawed herself from stool to floor. She began to writhe, cackle, and cough her laughter uncontrollably out. Her eyes watering, she nearly pooed. Bob spied what might be a dime-sized and expanding moisture blossom from her rear end center, signifying, perhaps, minimal ass piss. Bob looked at her rolling and cackling on the floor. She could only hand gesture to remind him not to look at her. Had the cover of their conversation not already been blown? Nonetheless, he succumbed and turned back to the mirror, where he found he now had to stand on the stool to gain a reflective angle that would allow him a sight line to the Eastern European hyena, who at the very least liked posting pictures. After several minutes of her spasmatic guffawing, Anna Surma began to compose herself, telling Bob,
"I know all about the Scottsdale program. People tell me everything because people like posts, Bob. I am a poster."
She informed him that Ludestar had left that business and that the Guineans now worked for a man she referred to as,
"You know who."
She described infighting within the man's own organization. It was a question of the value casinos placed on the one-armed bandits, so profitable to their business. Yet there was a counter-argument of their deflationary presence in a modern world of such branding bonanza. Ludestar, she said, had gotten into the sex trade, human trafficking, and according to Anna Surma, was himself financed by,
"You know who."
Her sources had identified Annie among the most recent of snatched sexual inventory.
"She's at the Marble Palace Hotel."
With that, Anna Surma excused herself.
"I happen to bring my bikini. I'm going to go to the back to the beach and get some late sun and post some selfies until the smoke clears and night falls.
Bob called after her.
People tell you everything?
Anna Surma glanced to him over her shoulder.
Everything, Bob, honey. That's the new world. Anna Surma, always in action.
Was her knowing to be trusted? Or were these perhaps the mimetic meanderings of a millennial so advanced by the evolution of informational access that it might render her information inexorably uninformative? Still, it was more actionable than any other intel he had at hand. As she exited, Bob turned to El Greco, finding his eyes on him. El Greco leaned toward Bob over the bar, beckoning Bob closer with an extended finger, and whispered to Bob,
Charlie Mike, my friend. Charlie Mike.
Bob suddenly understood.
Charlie Mike. Military slang for continue mission.
After paying his tab, he moved to exit the bar, trailed by El Greco's salutation.
Shukran.
Without turning back, Bob said, You're welcome. Mallet secure beneath Bob's jacket, he exited the hotel to the street. With notable exceptions, emergency workers, barricades, cadaver dogs, toxicity teams, and overhead media helicopters, South Beach had become a ghost town. Public threat assessments considered potential additional bombing activity within the city, and authorities had encouraged shop owners to close, residents to stay in, and tourists to flood the airport in hopes of flight. Bob serpentined his way through the barricades to his line of departure, then set off through the heavy shopping district. He, a nearly lone figure surrounded by signage. Famous faces of models and movie stars, their airbrushed images like unexploded ordnances in a minefield of storefront windows. Billboards both electric and paper. Was it they, or the scent of Semtex filling the air? This conundrum represented a problem set all its own for Bob. Considering it a coefficient of variation, he carried on. As he approached the grand facade of the Marble Palace, he considered it maybe a hardened site. He paused and perused it as a patrol car cruised him suspiciously. He nodded toward the hotel, as if indicating he were a guest returning to his abode. The patrol car moved on. One foot, then the other, Bob breached the Marble Palace entrance. He took another step, then another, to re-experience the echo of his shoes on the marble floor, against its walls, gold-gilded halls and ceiling. He was startled to notice that the hotel stereo system was playing Marconi's Gabriel's Oboe. The music moved him to his monkey mind's mea culpa. Bob approached the concierge desk. There, a slender young black male in suit and tie stood behind the desk, speaking to Bob as Bob approached.
Feeling better?
Asked the man.
Better?
Bob asked. He took his last steps forward toward the young man across the counter, with the intention of further questioning this fella's oddly familiar inquiry. As the man sat himself, it was then that Bob saw the bottom of the man's waistcoat lift, exposing the top band of a grass skirt. Bob catapulted into combat. The music took over Bob's mind, and his mastery of the mallet left the lewd star operative on the floor, head cracked open like a coconut split by a vice. The ballet had begun. Bob flashed on the surveillance camera above the concierge desk. He'd been made. No sooner than the first of Ludstar's troops exited the elevator did Bob dispatch them. Between marble, mallet, and mayhem was Bob most in his element. In these halls of magic stone could Bob read its patterns. Its movement of faces, ancient and contemporary, spoke to and navigated him. A wizard's cape breezed Bob to the stairwell. A dragon's tail pointed him to the fourth floor, rise on oboe. Behind the hallway door, he heard their mumbling. The Guinean grumbling disbursement of fire teams. No offense to the dragon, but Bob assumed higher ups to higher floors as he bounded up the staircase, just one more floor to a suddenly open door. Face to face, he popped three tribesmen. Weasels down, how many more? Now he rushed the corridor. Rise of strings, room 331 just to his right, as the choir sings. With his mallet, Bob Honey popped the lock. It was time to catch his breath, take a moment out of sight and a little bit of stock. But inside the room, the television was on. A Duck Dynasty star spoke conventionally for the artist of Khan. Pundits reported their version, inured to the preposterous perversion, a singularly immoral inversion. When Bob saw the bathroom door, he gave it 3 inquisitive taps with the mallet, and then one more. A voice from behind the door.
That's you, my brother?
Bob had heard that voice before. 13 years earlier, when he bought minutes from a vendor on a Baghdad street, it was undeniably the Guinean accent abrogating Oxford English of Lewdstar himself. From inside the bathroom, Lewdstar yelled,
Call me a case of Kuru!
Kuru, a virus contracted through ingestion of infected human brain matter.
I crackin' a grizz, my brother.
Cracking a grizz, street colloquialism for taking a shit.
Give a man a minute.
Bob contemplated the RUF.
Rough, or rules for use of force. Domestic military terminology differentiating from its Aconis counterpart, RO, rules of engagement.
My brother, can you turn the TV up? I've been waiting to hear what my man from Duck Dynasty got to say.
Where's Annie? Bob blurted through the door.
Lose the hero dreams. They no damsel in distress here.
He went on.
Let me wipe my ass. We'll hear out the Duck Dynasty boy. Then I'll get you some girls and some drugs.
Bob found himself at the end of his rope. He kicked in the door of the bathroom. Lewdstar, still sitting on the toilet, grass skirt around his ankles. Bob had barely made assessment upon entry when Lewdstar's pursed lip sent a dart careening through a 3-foot length of bamboo tubing. Bob's eyes crossed, observing its trajectory, as the tree sap poison dart pierced his nose into thickened cartilage. But before Lewdstar could reload, Bob bashed him. As Lewdstar crumbled to the floor like a bloody bag of smashed asshole, Bob pulled the dart from his nose before the poison had much chance to absorb. He dropped the dart into the waste bin beside the fallen tribesman. Back in the marble corridor, he moved back to the stairwell where the faces of time now guided him to its highest floor. It made sense to Bob that whoever was in charge of this outfit would most likely have chosen a suite with a roof garden. The piccolo played. Hearing the sounds of assembled tribesmen now seemingly coming his way from all directions, Bob slipped out a window from the stairwell where he was able to launch himself sill to fire escape. He made a rapid ascent where he disappeared over the building's edge, collapsing briefly onto the roof garden. Beyond a grinding air conditioning unit, Bob saw what appeared to be a skylight. He skull-dragged his way toward it. Looking down into the room below, he saw the ghastly freckled back and the golden blonde hair of a man pouncing, fucking a slender blonde woman. It was Annie, he thought. His arm went back. He crashed the mallet through the skylight, its shattering glass raining down on the bed below. The girl screamed through the choir of marbleized sirens of song. The pummeling man flounced, exposing a glance of the girl's face to Bob. Paradigm shift. It wasn't Annie at all. Nonetheless, had he found Lewdstar's financier? Had he stumbled upon the towering titan of treachery? Bob jumped into the skylight, landing on the bed below. He popped up onto his feet, remembering, slow is smooth, smooth is fast, and bloody is slippery. As he arched back to land the mallet on the man's blonde head, instead, a .223 round from the rifle of a non-Guinean bodyguard pierced Bob's head, edging his cerebral cortex. His body seized, folding to the floor. Warm blood escaping his head, curled by the marble deck. The nude girl, seeking the solace of a wrapped bedsheet, trembled in paralytic panic, pleading for her passport. Before the arrival of paramedics or police, the unscathed blonde man was extracted by helicopter from the roof garden, leaving Bob barely breathing in the sky's broken glass. In less an oddity of adjudication than a predictability of political obfuscation and skullduggery, Bob was never charged with a crime. His neurocranial injury, while relatively superficial, left a mark on his mind. A mark on his mind. They must be blind. They cannot see what Bob Honey sees.
Station 11. Debunking Camus.
In Bob's morphine dreams at Jackson Memorial, did the desert debunk Camus, the Algerian-born Frenchman who'd proposed truth? Like light blinds. Falsehood, on the contrary, is a beautiful twilight that enhances every object. His dream's desert lights diffusion by day dictated disturbances in the void of visual detail. Rocks not yet sharpened by shadow. Colors washed clear by a high sun. Flat light sight for Bobby Boy was no sight at all.
Button, 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 belly button.
Bob practiced the Zen breath of Annie's book, extending his dream of the desert till the sun set. Now, Bob thought, could something truer be told? If you've never flown a single-engine aircraft in a South Sudanese sandstorm, put your seatbelt on. Drifting into his dream were Democrats from the next bed's TV. Philadelphia feeling the burn. Daytime speeches twist and turn, and celebrities yearn to be close to those taking advantage of an evening stage turn. The president spoke, drawing an oratory ace from beneath his cloak. Bob listened but never woke. The wind and tumbleweed of his dry desert land whispered a speech from its own parched earth and sand. Then the television switched to a German rock band. Sometimes I like to lie. I don't know why. I don't know why. In this desert of Bob's dream did disturbances seem a truth of beauty. For the first time did Bob feel himself apart when the low light's heart declared the desert's directive. Sometimes I fool strangers. I tell them wrong names. I tell them lies. And they're mostly the same. When I tell them about my past, there is nothing that'll last. The sun's shocking red line drops behind a summit of time. Sometimes I say the truth, maybe just because of my youth. Sometimes I like to lie. I don't know why. When an orderly returned to the channel of the president's speech, Bob began regaining consciousness. Felt the president speaking to him and speaking to you. Hard in this world to be an elegant man, Bob thought. But when his game's on, that Kenyan Kansan can. Then there she was, the woman of our political hour entering stage left. If Bob's trust could be measured, it was in boxing terms. She'd put in the gym hours, far more than her share, believing ours would be a country that discerns when laid so bare. She smiles and hugs the president. The crowds rise up in glee. Her opponent might be tweeting, admonishing repugnantly. As the orderly reduces volume, Bob hears a distant choo-choo whistle. Just a click or two from the hospital. Cargo containers on rail ride station to station. City acoustics travel trains with doubtless purpose. Sounds of morphine all their own. Sounds that built this country with black and Chinese hands and the genocide of Indian bands. As the orderly left the room, he uttered, "Every war we've ever lost has been somebody else's civil war." Bob sat up in bed and through the window watched Old Glory waving wistfully atop an adjacent building's spire. He muttered aloud,
"I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all."
The Pledge of Allegiance was written by a socialist in 1892. The version above, specifying the United States in 1923. In 1954 were the words "Under God" added in response to the communist threat.
Bob lay back on the bed, pulled an iPod from the bed tray, eared up, and pressed play. Phil Oakes' voice. "It's always the old who lead us to the war. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?"
Caboose.
Blank-eyed and bandaged head, Bob exited a small white shuttle van, paid its driver, grabbed his two suitcases, and moved slowly into the assisted living facility branded with the new president's name. He walked past wheelchaired VFW members and decrepit oxygen tank breathers. He moved to the admissions desk. At the desk, a bioluminescently beautiful young woman with the clearest brown eyes, a face so familiar, he must have known her from somewhere.
"May I help you?"
she asked, her accent from across the Atlantic.
"I want to be admitted."
"Well, of course. Name?
Bob thought long and hard, then...
Pariah. Pappy Pariah.
Let me get you sorted, Mr. Pariah,
said the beautiful young girl. After some time in processing, an orientation tour, and the assignment of a residence on the second floor, the beautiful young woman walked Bob to his room. After unlocking the door, she handed him the key.
This will be your new home.
Bob nodded. As he entered his room, consumed of antiseptic air, he began to close the door, leaving the young woman in the hallway, but her hand stopped the door from closing. He offered little resistance, and she pushed it back open ajar. She said,
Are you better now, Bob Beam?
He answered,
I'm better now, Annie.
The beautiful young woman leaned between the door and the jamb, kissing Bob's cheek gently. They closed the door between them, and in the corridor he heard her footsteps patter away into silence, and in that silence did his solipsism sing. Bob found his bag sitting in front of the bed where an orderly had prepositioned them. He went to the window of the retirement home and opened the blinds. There in the parking lot, he saw his old Pontiac drive up. Behind the wheel, Spurley Coulthier. Who knew what may be that bastard Spurley's weapon of choice? Likely a G-U-N, spelled P-U-S-S-Y. Or maybe a piano wire garret, spelled Q-U-I-E-T. Bob considered this briefly, then went to one of his suitcases, zipped it open. From inside, he pulled a sleeping mask, an iPod, and an envelope addressed to the ASPCA with a bundle of cash inside. He laid on his bed, pulled the sleeping mask over his eyes, put the earpieces into his ears, and set the envelope on his chest, then pressed play on the iPod. Phil Oakes sang, I can see him coming. He's walking down the highway. With his big boots on and his big thumb out, he wants to get me. He wants to hurt me. He wants to bring me down. But sometime later, when I feel a little straighter, I will come across a stranger who will remind me of the danger. And then, I'll run him over. Pretty smart on my part. Find my way home. In the dark. R.I.P. Spurley Coulthier. And Bob, honey, a being unbranded, unbridled, and free. The end.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Bob, Honey, Who Just Do Stuff. Written by Pappy Pariah. Read by Sean Penn with Francis McDormand, Layla George, and Ari Fliakos. Executive producers Keith O'Connell and Mike Charzik. Produced and directed by Kat Lambrix. Edited and mastered by Brian Corcoran. Mixed by Chris Sacco. Produced under license from Elektra Entertainment Group, Inc. Courtesy of A&M Records, under license from Universal Music Enterprises, a division of UMG Recordings, Inc. The Phil Oakes songs were published by Barricade Music, Inc. and administered by Almo Music Corp. on behalf of Phil Oakes. Working Class Hero, written by John Lennon. Copyright 1970, renewed by Lenono Music. All rights administered by Downtown Music Publishing, LLC. All rights reserved. Used by permission. Sometimes I Like to Lie, by Anan May Kantareit and Henning May. All rights administered by Erzin Management. Used by permission. Copyright 2016 by Clyde is Hungry Films, Inc. Production copyright 2016 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.